Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, author David Marinus discusses his new book, Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe, the definitive biography of a great American athlete who struggled most of his life to overcome racist stereotypes. Marinus is an associate editor at the Washington Post and a distinguished visiting professor at Vanderbilt University. He has won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for journalism and was a finalist 3 other times. Among his best-selling books are the biographies of Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Roberto Clemente, and Vince Lombardi, and a trilogy about the 1960s, Rome, 1960, Once in a Great City, winner of the RFK Book Prize, and They Marched into Sunlight, winner of the J. Anthony Lucas Prize and Pulitzer finalist in history. Marinus is interviewed by Kelly Weiskopf, professor of English and a director of the Kaplan Institute for the Humanities at Northwestern University, where she is also an affiliate of the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research.
David, it's so nice to meet you. Glad you're in Chicago, and thanks for sitting down to talk about
Absolutely. Your
new book, Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. Listeners might have heard about Thorpe pretty recently, in July of 2022, so just a few months ago, the International Olympic Committee restored his medals and acknowledged him as sole winner of the decathlon and pentathlon at the 1912 Stockholm Games. Even though Thorpe is recently in the news, he's someone whose story I think you've probably been thinking about for a long time. So could you talk about what it was about Thorpe and his story that made you decide to write a biography of him?
Yes. I consider this sort of the third book in a trilogy of sports books, sports biographies, first Vince Lombardi, then Roberto Clemente, and now Jim Thorpe. And in all three cases, I'm looking for 2 things. One is the drama of the story told through sports, and then to use that as a way to illuminate American history and sociology. So Jim Thorpe qualifies for that. He was a fabulous athlete, and I saw the chance to use his life as a way to explore the Native American experience through that period of time.
That's wonderful. Let's talk a little bit about that Native American experience as we understand it through Thorpe's life. And maybe let's start with Carlisle Industrial School, the boarding school where Thorpe went and where he got his start playing athletics. One of the things that was interesting for me about the book is the ways that this story of Carlisle requires us to hold some contradictions together. Mm. So he meets his wife there. He meets other Native folks he's friends with for the rest of his life. You write that his daughter says years later that Thorpe told her his happiest years were at Carlisle. As you also point out in the book, Carlisle is an institution dedicated to assimilation,
yes,
to severing Native people's relationships to their families and homelands, insisting that they speak only English and so on. And I'm interested in what we can understand about Carlisle from the perspective of sports. So you say in the preface that football in particular was considered at Carlisle a central component of the assimilation process. So could you talk about how sports and athletics are part of this process of assimilation at Carlisle? And how do you think this shaped Thorpe as an athlete and as a person?
Well, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School was not just assimilation, it was forced assimilation,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
And as you point out, it was to rid the Native Americans of all of their heritage, culture, language, religion, you know, shear their locks and dress them in the uniforms of the U.S. Cavalry.
Yeah.
But in terms of football, in that era, football was pretty much of an upper middle class sport. Mm-hmm. And the great football teams were Harvard and Yale and Princeton and West Point. And it was considered that football would be another way of assimilating these Native American athletes.
Yeah.
And that's why they emphasized that sport. And they became very good at it. And, you know, the whole notion of Carlisle as a contradiction, I think, reflects the larger contradictions of the way white society has regarded Native Americans throughout history, which is, on the one hand, to romanticize them and diminish them at the same time,
yeah,
you know, unlike African Americans in that sense. And so I think Carlisle was part of that process, where for Jim Thorpe, the contradiction was that we wouldn't know of him without Carlisle. Mm-hmm. That's where he rose to fame, through football and track and field. On the other hand, some aspects of Carlisle were cruel and dehumanizing to not just him, but to any student who went through that school.
Yeah, I really appreciate your point about the ways that American society and policy romanticizes Native people, creates these stereotypical images of them,
yes.
and tries to eliminate them at the same time, right? So Carlyle coming on the heels of the so-called Indian Wars and a kind of attempt to eliminate Native people, just not on the battlefield.
Exactly. The motto of the founder of Carlyle was kill the Indian, save the man.
Yeah.
It was founded in 1879, only 3 years after the Battle of Little Bighorn.
Yeah.
The first students there were mostly Lakota Sioux, the sons and daughters of the warriors who had fought against the U.S. Army and been killed by them, many of them. And so it was that was considered part of the taming, quote unquote, of those people to assimilate into a white society. Jim Thorpe, you know, just by coincidence for my purposes, was born in 1887, the year of the Dawes Act, which was another effort to sort of through land grabs to force Native Americans to handle their property and their society more like white people did and take away their communal property.
Yeah, and Carlyle being a key part of that.
Yes.
This is a little bit of a kind of associative leap, but one of the things that your book made me think about is Lee Ann Howe's novel, Miko Kings. For people listening, it's M-I-K-O Kings. So she's writing about a Native baseball team in the early 20th century. She is interested in the ways that Native people influenced baseball and also in the Native origins of baseball. So ancient stickball games and other games that Native people are playing for a long time. And one of the things she thinks about, kind of to your point about romanticization, is the ways Native people are made mascots in sports and made into racist stereotypes in American baseball and football in particular, even as they're innovators of the game, they're champions of the game, like Thorpe. Could you talk a little bit about how you see Thorpe challenging that process of romanticizing Native people and the stereotypes that are being created about Native people in the 20th century?
Well, throughout his career, he was the sports writers who thought they were championing him in some ways. Nonetheless, they always portrayed he and his teammates as being on the warpath, taking scalps, right? I mean, all of those stereotypes of what they suspected an Indian would be like. And the interesting thing is that the Native American athletes were sort of understood that game. They understood that they had to sort of meet some of the expectations of white society, which also included performing at halftime, various, you know, wearing headdresses and doing all of the things that whites expected them to do. They were, in a sense, almost gaming that system as a way of surviving, in my opinion. And I think Jim understood that throughout his life. He, like the novel, you know, he played on several all Native athletic teams, not just Carlyle, but also the Oorang Indians in football, a professional team, and Harjo's Indians, a professional baseball team. And in all of those cases, the players would have Anglo names, but they would use their Indian names mostly to just sort of be appealing to the white society. That's a contradiction that I find fascinating, you know, that they understood how to maneuver between those different cultures in a way to survive.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about it in relation to Carlyle's project of transforming Native people into white people. And yet we see Thorpe, you know, finding friendships with other Native people through these football and baseball teams that are all Native teams. So thinking about the different ways Native people find to build communities with each other, even in this world of assimilation and allotment and so on. I appreciate that point about what those teams might do.
And the other point about that I find fascinating is that particularly Carlyle, that football team, was very popular because they were exotic, right? So wherever they went, playing Harvard or Yale or Princeton or West Point, there would be huge crowds to see them because they were Native Americans playing for a school that was trying to rid them of that very fact. You know, it's such a contradiction.
And Carlyle kind of benefiting from this too.
Absolutely.
Vaunting it as one of the things they're really good at the same time that they're trying to eradicate it. Yeah, that seems really to tap into something about American culture, this sort of desire for indigeneity, for belonging to this place, mm-hmm. and this desire to rid the continent of Native people altogether. So I think about another book, Phil DeLorey's Playing Indian, and the kind of ways that white Americans really want indigenousness, but actually don't want Native people.
That book really helped me understand that whole process very much, yes.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about the ways that sports journalists are representing Thorpe and his teammates and how they talk in kind of stereotypical racist terms about them being on the warpath and so on. One of the things that I was so interested in this book is how closely you work with newspaper accounts of Thorpe and his career. And in some ways, it seems like if this book is mainly about Thorpe, it is also in some ways about sports journalism in the early and on into the mid 20th century, what it got right about Native athletes, about Thorpe, and also what it got wrong. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what that process of relying on newspapers as your primary sources was, and how you worked to both distinguish between stereotype and fiction and truth around Thorpe, and how you tried to make that distinction clear for your readers.
Well, it's important to understand that this was before television. Yeah. Radio wasn't even the main way of conveying information about sports in that period. It was sports writers. And Jim Thorpe is both a real person and a mythological figure. And so it was very important to me to understand how that myth was created. It was through sports writing, and that's why I concentrate on that. Although, you know, I did go to 22 different archives to get other primary documents, but newspapers were the essential way of understanding the way he was perceived by the public in that era through sports writers. You know, ranging from the iconic Grantland Rice, who was Thorpe's champion throughout Rice's long writing career, but was also a myth maker, you know, and tried to write about the glory of sports and not the reality of sports. And even Rice, as he was championing Thorpe, also pervaded some of the stereotypes as well, as did almost every sports writer that I encountered during that period. But I don't think there was, in the most cases, it was just unwittingly. I don't think they were trying to diminish the Native American athletes. I think they thought they were championing them, but it was so ingrained into the white perceptions that they just continued with that. Because most of those sports writers, for instance, when Jim Thorpe had his medals taken away, they supported him. So I think they thought they were being positive, but they were nonetheless reinforcing all these stereotypes. So how do I deal with it in the book? I mean, I don't like to be didactic, but I think it becomes clear as you read the stories how they are sort of mishandling the information in that sense. The gym had to put up every Indian athlete was called chief, you know, and they weren't chiefs, right? And that goes back to Chief Bender, Albert Bender, you know, another great Carlisle athlete who was a terrific pitcher in the major leagues. And then Thorpe was called chief when he was in the minor leagues, and his catcher and for the Giants was called chief. I mean, it's just all of them are chiefs. They're all, as I said, on the warpath taking scalps, you know, no matter what they're doing. And even as those journalists are trying to support them, they're using that same terminology.
Yeah, I really appreciate the ways that the book doesn't, it's not didactic, it's not preachy, but it very clearly helps readers track how these stereotypes are working. And maybe that's because you also give us this sense of Thorpe as somebody who is a person and not simply a stereotype, that he's a person who has a family back in Sac and Fox territory in Oklahoma, who has relationships with folks at Carlisle. So the book, I think, models the ways that we can understand these stereotypes and where they came from and the work they did historically, but also read them really critically. I really appreciated that. Great. You mentioned the medals, so let's talk about the medals and the controversy regarding Thorpe's eligibility. What stood out to you in this story? It may be the thing people know most about Thorpe, perhaps. So I'm interested in you know, what stood out for you, what's at stake for all of the people here in whether Thorpe gets the medals and is recognized as sole winners. Let's maybe just start there.
Sure. Well, he lost the medals because he had played Bush League baseball in the Eastern Carolina League for minimal pay for two summers. And that came out, even though at the time he was doing that, scores of college athletes were playing summer baseball for money. But almost all of them are using aliases. You know, the story was that in the Eastern Carolina League, there were so many aliases that it was called the Pocahontas League because everybody was named John Smith. Dwight Eisenhower played under an alias in the Kansas State League of Wilson. Jim Thorpe played under the name Jim Thorpe. He never tried to hide it. It was in the newspapers in North Carolina for all that whole period he was playing because his name was in the box scores and everybody knew it was Jim Thorpe. But after he won the gold medals several years later, the story broke on the East Coast in New England, and then it became this huge scandal, quote unquote. What struck me most, actually, aside from the moral injustice and the technical injustice, was the hypocrisy. The moral injustice was that, how do you define an amateur, was another member of that 1912 Olympic team, George S. Patton, the future general, an amateur, when he was training for military-style events in the modern pentathlon and getting paid by the Army at the same time, whereas Jim Thorpe was playing baseball that had nothing to do with the events he was playing. So many different aspects of the question of amateurism. Then there was a technical injustice in that the actual Olympic rules said that any challenge to amateurism had to be filed within 30 days of the end of the Olympics. Jim Thorpe's story didn't break until 6 months later. But then there was this hypocrisy, which was that all of the powerful white men who knew exactly what Jim Thorpe was doing lied about it to save their own reputations. That included Pop Warner, his coach at Carlisle, who had been recruiting his Indian athletes to play summer baseball for years. One of his best friends was the scout who brought Thorpe and two other Carlisle athletes down to Carolina. So Pop Warner knew, but when the story broke, he denied it and said he had no knowledge of it. The superintendent at Carlisle, Moses Friedman, knew. He had been writing letters that I have to Thorpe saying, don't play summer baseball. So he definitely knew what was going on. James E. Sullivan, the head of the Amateur Athletic Union and of the American Olympic Committee, was also on the advisory board of the Carlisle Athletic Association. He knew. All three of these very powerful figures, to save their own reputations, just basically let Jim be the fall guy for this whole semi-corrupt system.
Yeah. And do you have a theory as to why? Like, why?
I think he was an easy target. I mean, I don't think it was entirely that he was a Native American, but yeah. I think that definitely was a factor. Absolutely.
And all the men go on to further careers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Sullivan, for instance, the amateur athlete of the year is given the Sullivan Award. Pop Warner, youth football is called the Pop Warner League, right? So, yes.
Yeah. Well, it's was good to see this summer that justice come to Thorpe after so many years.
After 110 years too late.
110 years, yeah. This sort of jumps ahead to the end of Thorpe's life, but I was so interested in the fact that he worked in Hollywood. Mm. So both trying to pick up parts in films about Native people, advocating for Native people to play themselves on screen as opposed to the practice of having white actors play Native people in red face, and also advocating for good conditions for Native actors working in Hollywood. This also seems to be a time when Thorpe is experiencing perhaps some of the most financial precarity of his entire life. So could you talk a little bit about this time in his life and how you see it connecting to his earlier days, if at all? Mm-hmm. How did researching the Hollywood stage of his career influence how you thought about him in this phase of his life?
You know, actually, when I started the book, as I said at the beginning, I knew that there would be a great story about his sporting life.
Yeah.
I really wanted to explore everything, you know, and so the final 30 years of his life were as important to me as the athletic years, because I thought that they would help illuminate the Native American experience, you know, that he would be emblematic of some of those struggles.
Yeah.
So he did struggle. I mean, he struggled with drinking. He struggled with jobs. He traveled to 20 different states, you know, during that period, mostly in Southern California, but he was also traveling around the country trying to survive. And I thought that as his athletic talents diminished, his identity as a Native American strengthened. He started, you know, when you're just doing sports, you tend to just think about that. So he wasn't as focused on the injustice that had been done to him until later. And similarly, just thinking about all of the struggles of his people sort of became more pronounced in that period, especially in Hollywood, where he did become really a leader, a spokesperson for 200 or 300 Native people who were on the fringes of that industry trying to get jobs, often those jobs going to white people and grease paint, you know, and fighting the negative stereotypes of so many Westerns, not all Westerns, but many of them.
Yeah.
So that was a very important period for him, even as he was really, you know, down on his luck in so many ways. I mean, for one part of that period, he was digging ditches, you know, for a hospital to be built, and working as a greeter in various taverns. But he kept going, and that's, you know, as I was writing those last years or researching them too, I kept rooting for something better to happen, you know, come on, let's, and it really doesn't in a way, but then I sort of was, is this a tragedy or not? In some ways there are tragic elements to it, but I didn't think it fell into that category so much as a story of perseverance, which I thought emblemized the entire Native population. You know, in 1915, I write about this statue that was so popular, you know, called the End of the Trail. And it was really evoking the notion that manifest destiny had prevailed, progress had rendered Native peoples anachronistic. They were dying, they would be dead soon. There were fewer than 300,000 in this country. And it didn't happen. You know, they found ways to survive and prevail, and now there are millions, you know. And so I saw Jim's efforts to keep going in that vein. And what really sort of solidified that notion for me were his descendants. You know, his seven children all were pretty successful. The men in military officers, the women getting college degrees, the grandchildren and great-grandchildren going on to do several, you know, wonderful things. So they survived.
Yeah. I appreciate your reading of that sculpture. There's a copy of it in the Art Institute here in Chicago.
Oh, is there?
There is, yeah. And the ways that as a writer, you really resist tragedy as a genre.
Mm.
And, you know, I think it is one of these pervasive narratives that American society tells itself about Native people.
Mm-hmm.
But I also appreciate the ways you say we have to look beyond Thorpe to what he made possible, to his descendants, to what they've done. Kind of building on that, because we're at the American Writers Museum, I wanted to ask a little bit about your practice as a writer. I appreciated your comment earlier that you had been to, I don't quite remember, 8 archives or a number of archives?
More than that.
Okay, yeah. To research Thorpe's life and to look at documents relating to him. You know, one of the things that struck me in the book is that he left relatively little writing about himself. So could we talk a little bit about your process as a researcher, what it was like to try to paint a portrait of somebody who didn't talk about himself in writing very much.
Yeah, I mean, that was my major concern before I started the book. Would I be able to get inside Jim Thorpe? Yeah. And I think that I succeeded. I shouldn't say succeed. I think that when I found a group of letters that he had written to his girlfriend and then second wife, that really sort of just opened up some parts of him that I couldn't find anywhere else. Those were at the Cumberland County Historical Society, which had bought them on an auction and made them public.
I was fascinated by that. Yeah. I read that footnote and I wanted to ask you about it. So I'm glad you brought it up.
And so those were all available to me, and that was really helpful. At the National Museum of the American Indian, they have the papers of one of his daughters, Grace Thorpe, and Jim Thorpe's third wife, Patsy, had written letters to Grace that were in that that file. And so that also helped a little bit. But that was, you know, athletes in general, it's harder to find sort of that documented letters that I could find for like Bill Clinton or you know, some other figures. But I did find enough to help me feel I was getting inside a little bit. Other than that, I had to rely on oral histories. One of the great things about the internet, which can be a force for evil as well, is that some primary documents are now digitized. So that saved me a lot of time.
Yeah.
The entire Carlisle Indian Industrial School papers are digitized, so I could find everything I needed there, which was especially important for this book because half of it was written during COVID.
Yeah, I think the practice of being in an archive is so important to the work, and you can really tell the ways it shapes this book. And the digital archives is too, being as important as the physical places for that.
I prefer doing it in person.
Yeah.
And I was able to go to many. I spent time at the Beinecke Archive at Yale, which had the papers of Richard Henry Pratt, the founder of Carlisle, and of N. Scott Momaday, the great novelist, you know, he who was fascinated by Thorpe and Carlisle. So I was lucky. I didn't realize that until I looked through his papers, and there it all was. University of Illinois has the papers of Avery Brundage, so all of the Olympic materials are there. Even the Rosenbach Library in Philadelphia had Marianne Moore's papers, and she unbelievably was a teacher at Carlisle when Jim Thorpe was there. That was fun to look
at. I loved that. And she sort of appears again when Carlisle is sort of unraveling, trying to stay out of the fray, but you can tell as you paint her, she's sort of there. And maybe has some opinions about Carlisle.
Yeah, she considered it a prison, basically.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you brought up the letters that Thorpe wrote to his second wife, because the chapters that are titled Letters 1 and Letters 2, for me, felt like a turning point in the book. And also, it felt like we got to know Thorpe in a way that those kind of sports journalists who are writing about him in his early life, you know, don't really get us into the person, into his relationships, into what he's feeling. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit more about the letters and just also kind of stylistically your decision to put them together kind of in the middle of the book and to reproduce a lot of the letters so we really get Thorpe's voice? I think in a way we don't in the earlier part of the book.
Yeah, I debated that some, but it was a lopsided debate because I realized pretty quickly that this is the way I wanted to do it. You know, rather than paraphrasing and weaving it into some larger part of the story, I wanted people to just stop and look with me into Jim Thorpe at those moments. So the first letters one, he's in Lawrence, Massachusetts, playing baseball, writing to his then girlfriend, who would become his second wife. And those letters are, you know, they show his romanticized, you know, his yearnings, his desires, you know, sexually and otherwise, the real person, you know, what a real person is like. And then the second group of letters, he's married to her now, he's in Florida, and those are almost, they're almost Willie Loman-esque, you know, he keeps, Florida is wide open. He thinks he's going to have a shot to do various things, sell real estate or be a promoter of football and boxing in Cuba. And he keeps writing her about something's about to happen good. And it never happens. And, you know, then he realizes, you know, he opens up about how down on his luck he is and how, you know, he's blue, you know, it's really a tough period for him. His athletic career is nearing its end and he's struggling, but he's still pushing and trying to, you know, there's something good that's going to happen. And that sort of opens up the rest of the book, which, you know, you keep hoping that will happen. And yeah. It doesn't.
Yeah. I appreciate that as like a window, a little bit of a window into him, but also a window into the latter part of his life where it's just, as you said earlier, he sort of keeps going and going and hoping something will happen. One of those things he hopes will happen is a film about his life. Mm. He sort of works on this with his third wife. Could you talk a little bit about that process and his hopes there and the kind of disappointments around that film?
Yeah, well, he'd signed an option for a film about his life 20 years before it was made. It took 20 years. It finally happened in 1951 when he was in the last years of his life. And it was, it's fascinating because the movie is sympathetic thinks it is. Burt Lancaster plays Jim Thorpe, you know, a movie star. Who also was sympathetic to the Native cause, but he wasn't a Native American. He was 37 years old. He plays Thorpe starting when Thorpe is 16 or supposed to be 16. But Lancaster's a good athlete, so that part of it is okay. The director is Michael Curtiz, who directed Casablanca, you know, the most famous movie in American history, or one of them. And the movie is sympathetic but wrong in every small respect and wrong in the largest respect. You know, it has mountains in Oklahoma, you know, it's all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But the real problem with it, in my opinion, was that the narrator is Pop Warner. And he's presented as the white savior. If only Jim had listened to him and better assimilated into society, he would have had the troubles he had. And I found that to be just classically white, wrong perspective on the whole thing.
Yeah. And yet another moment where it's not Jim getting to tell his own story.
No, it's right? not. And yeah. it's not, you know, there was obviously absolutely no even thought in that era that maybe we could tell this through the Native perspective.
Yeah.
It just wasn't done.
It's really interesting thinking about Thorpe's advocacy for Native people, you know, playing Native characters in films alongside the recent kind of wave of TV shows.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm thinking about Rutherford Falls and Reservation Dogs,
yeah.
written, directed, acted in by Native people.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of think about Thorpe as somebody who's hoping and imagining a 2022 when there are going to be two great and TV shows directed by Native actors, directors and featuring Native actors.
Well, I've always said that all of my books are in various stages of not being made into movies. And I don't care if it's based on my book or not, but I think that a story of Jim Thorpe told through a Native American director and actors would be fabulous.
I hope they're listening to this podcast because I agree. as we kind of wind down, you know, I want to ask what you hope readers take away from encountering Thorpe's story, the letters he wrote, the speeches he gave, his activism, his athleticism. What do you hope readers take from the book?
Well, you know, I think readers often read into a book what they take from their own lives. Mm-hmm. So, my effort is to try to let that in and then teach them something as well, you know. So if people come into it just thinking of Jim Thorpe as this great athlete, I want them to understand it in the context of what he dealt with as a Native American. And as I said earlier, I think that it's really a lesson in survival and persistence, and which I think emblemizes the entire Native population.
Yeah. I think you're going to read a little bit from the book to wind us down.
I was going to read from the preface.
It's a great preface, too.
The late Reuben Snake, one-time chairman of the American Indian Movement and member of the Winnebago Nation, said that to be an Indian meant having every third person you meet tell you about his great-grandmother, who was a real Cherokee princess, and 9 out of 10 people tell you how great Jim Thorpe was. Thorpe, in that sense, was one of the few Native Americans of the 20th century whom people could cite and praise, even if they knew little else about the indigenous experience. From the moment I started telling acquaintances that I was writing a book about Thorpe, the reply was often some variation of, "Oh, I read a book about him in fourth grade." Many of those people were in fourth grade long before there was much effort to diversify school libraries. Thorpe was the archetype, a gifted athlete, and a stereotype, the romanticized noble Indian. He was a foundation story of American sports. As with most public figures of that sort, the man became shrouded in myth. As a biographer, I'm interested in both, the making of the man and the creation of the myth. Born in 1887 in the Indian Territory of what would later become Oklahoma, Thorpe was the quintessential underdog who rose from nowhere to become the greatest athlete in the world, the natural who could do anything on the fields of play. He was an Olympic champion decathlete in track and field, a football All-American, a star pro and first president of what became the National Football League, and a Major League Baseball player, a seemingly indestructible force who ran like a wild horse thundering downhill, yet was also a graceful ballroom dancer and gifted swimmer and ice skater. When people display such rare physical gifts, there's a tendency to lift them into the realm of the superhuman, as if human magnificence is insufficient. That was certainly true with Thorpe. The hyperbolic stories told by writers and sports fans over the decades could fill many notebooks. As is also often the case, there were times when Thorpe became the storyteller of his own legend. Jim loved to recall the tale of how at Carlisle he brilliantly ran a punt back for a touchdown against Army, and when the score was nullified by a penalty, he simply repeated his touchdown gallop on the next play. He was indeed the dominant player in that game, but the back-to-back touchdown runs never happened. Nor is there any truth to his boast that during a baseball game in Texarkana, he hit 3 home runs into 3 separate states, Arkansas, Texas, and Oklahoma. He did hit 3 home runs, but the 3-state hat trick was a geographic impossibility. Myth-making, in the American tradition of George Washington, Paul Bunyan, Davy Crockett, and Babe Ruth. But there was another myth at the center of the Thorpe story, a deeper and more pernicious myth that had to do with the history and treatment of the American Indian, the myth that the Great White Father knows best. Thorpe's life spanned a 60-year period when the dominant society believed the best way to deal with Indians was to rid them of their Indianness and make them as white as possible. It was that mentality that shaped Thorpe's life. Much of the territory of his Sac and Fox and Potawatomi people was lost when the federal government moved to strip them of communal property, opening up vast swaths of territory to the land rushes that white Oklahoma settlers and their descendants celebrated as boomer sooner frontier derring do. As a teenager, he was sent away to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania, the federal government's flagship Indian boarding school, where the focus was more on forced acculturation than on education, and the methods were crude, cruel, and dehumanizing. Football, as a college sport then largely the province of Ivy League good old boys, was considered a central component of the assimilation process. A biographer's responsibility is to acknowledge the complexity of human existence, its many contradictions, cross currents, and nuances. For all of Carlisle's failings and questionable intentions, some of its students considered their boarding school years among the best of their lives. Jim sometimes claimed that himself. It's fair to say that few would know or care about him had he not gone there and shown his unmatched athletic skills to the nation and the world. Whether he would have had a happier life without the surrounding hoopla of fame is another matter. He was not a loner and had a touch of mischief to him, but he was innately modest and comfortable away from the limelight. He was most relaxed while stalking the woods or sitting on a riverbank or ocean pier, hunting or fishing. In the years after his playing skills faded, his life was troubled by alcohol, broken marriages, deferred dreams, lost opportunities, and financial distress resulting from a generosity that lapsed into wastefulness. He was the American nomad, migrating from job to job, state to state, in search of a peace he never found before he died of a heart attack in a trailer park in Southern California in 1953 at age 65. At times, Jim was his own worst enemy, yet throughout his life, he had to deal with powerful white men who tried to control his fate. Some presented themselves as his savior, others as his moral superior. The most notable example of the savior type was Pop Warner, Jim's coach at Carlisle. In Jim Thorpe All-American, the 1951 movie version of his life, Thorpe, played by movie star Burt Lancaster, is the main character, but Warner, who consulted on the script, is portrayed as the hero and wise man who discovered the raw athlete, molded him into a superstar, and then tried time and again in later years to save Jim from his worst impulses. The true story is less flattering. Warner was a hypocrite, if not a coward. At the time of Jim's greatest peril, when his Olympic medals were being taken from him because he'd played Bush League baseball, Pop lied and feigned innocence to save his own reputation while portraying Jim as the ignorant native. There's strong evidence that James E. Sullivan, then the big man of American amateur athletics and the person most responsible for the decision to deny Thorpe his medals and records, was also duplicitous during that ordeal, even as he claimed to be upholding the righteous cause of pure amateurism. And then there was Avery Brundage, once a decathlete himself, a teammate and rival of Jim's at the 1912 Stockholm Olympics. Brundage performed miserably there and dropped out of the competition when the going got tough. An early refutation of his later bromide that in the Olympic ideal, participation was what mattered, not performance. He went on to a high-flying career as the holier-than-thou arbiter of all things amateur in the world of sports, and for decades, as he rose through the ranks from president of the U.S. Olympic Committee to head of the International Olympic Committee, he consistently refused to reconsider the injustice done to Thorpe, often complaining that he, not Jim, was the victim of unfair treatment. In the long list of Brundage misdeeds, others were more inexcusable, especially his cozying up to the Nazi organizers of the 1936 Games in Berlin, but his condescending and dismissive attitude toward Thorpe stood as Exhibit A in the hypocrisy of moral superiority. Thorpe's unparalleled athletic accomplishments did not make his life triumphant. His days were marked by loss, the loss of tribal lands, the loss of his twin brother in childhood, the loss of his namesake son at age 3, the loss of his Olympic medals and records, his loss of money and security and equilibrium. There's a temptation, then, to view his story as tragedy, but I emerged from my study of his life with a different interpretation. It's also a story of perseverance against the odds. For all his troubles, whether caused by outside forces or of his own doing, Jim Thorpe did not succumb. He did not vanish into whiteness. The man survived, complications and all, and so did the myth.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer David W. Blight chats with scholar Dr. Kedrick Roy about the life and legacy of Frederick Douglass. Recorded live at the American Writers Festival, this episode coincides with the launch of our new exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice, now open at the American Writers Museum. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.